The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Susie Pratt. This story is called Changing the Past by Barton Paul Levinson. 29th century Texas, like much of the rest of the world, was hot, dry, and windy. Sewell, son of Menck, stood outside the National Research Arena in dusty air that smelled of boiled cabbage, his cloak wrapped tightly around him. Three white-robed elders stood with him. The setting sun left long shadows everywhere. One elder reached out to take Sewell's hands.
"You agree with our aims?"
"Very much so.
We all have those we love in this world, but it is a sad, dying world. Your actions will eliminate all you know if your mission succeeds."
"I understand this, Elder. For the good of mankind it must be done, otherwise human history will be short and miserable."
"I know.
Jant?"
Another elder, a woman, reached into her robes and drew out two glass cylinders, one with shiny green powder within, one with red.
"We know, Sewell, that you are a great warrior, proficient with all manner of weapons, or even with no weapons. But the major goal of this mission, please keep this in mind, is to save life, not take it. Thus, these weapons, which are non-lethal, at least in their immediate effects. The green causes sleep, the red, extreme suggestibility. You understand the plan?"
"I do."
He took the vials and put them in his cloak. The third elder spoke.
"We have identified the crucial nexus at which human history went wrong. The learned among us debated this a long time, with methods ranging from formal logic to computer simulation. You know what happened on November 22, 1963, and the results."
"Yes, slowly increasing violence, culminating in the disaster which led to the world as it is. Our world." The first elder said,
"Sewell, go with all our love and goodwill.
Frustrate Mr. Lee Oswald. Change the future of President John Kennedy."
"I will do my best."
Sewell walked into the arena. Guards helped him change into clothing suited for early 1960s North America. They gave him U.S. currency, all dated 1963 or earlier. A red-cloaked philosopher said, "We will put you in the sixth floor at the Texas Book Depository." The man embraced him. "Go out to the center of the field." Sewell did so. The air lit up around him, and he stood in a room full of stacked cartons at 12:28 p.m., 11:22:63. The only light came from a window. The room smelled of paper dust, sweat, and fried chicken. Sewell went around the boxes. A carton of Kentucky Fried lay on the floor next to the sniper's nest. Lee Harvey Oswald, in dark slacks and a white t-shirt, knelt on the floor, holding the 6.5mm Mannlicher Carcano rifle. The bolt was already pulled back. The assassin trembled.
"I can't do it," he whispered. "I can't. I can't back shoot the guy. Oh, God, I can't do it."
Sewell stepped up to him. "I know, Lee, and that is to your credit. You are a bad man, a traitor, a wife beater, a fool with an exaggerated sense of self-importance, but in the end, you are not a murderer." Oswald let go of the rifle and stared.
"Who the hell are you?"
"I am Sewell, a warrior of the enforcers, from what you would call the 29th century. The sad fact is that, because you are not a murderer at heart, Kennedy lives. And there is a nuclear war in 1967. By my time, the human race is dying, all because you could not pull a trigger."
"What? What? What kind of bullshit is this?"
"It doesn't matter. I like giving speeches a personal failing." Sewell pulled out the green vial and sprayed Oswald in the face. The assassin collapsed against the wall, draped awkwardly over a book carton. Sewell took the rifle, aimed carefully, and squeezed off 3 shots. The third hit President Kennedy in the head. Sewell carefully wiped off his fingerprints, then pulled Oswald to a more upright position and placed his hand on the rifle. "Wake up, Lee." The man shook his head groggily.
"The fuck? What? What happened? Me?"
"Listen, I just shot President Kennedy. You'd better run, Lee. The police will be up here any moment now."
"What? What?"
Oswald looked out the window, shots hitting the building, and he drew back.
"But I didn't do it! I didn't do it!"
"I know, Lee. I did it. But you'll be charged with it, as they say in your time. Them's the breaks." Sewell jogged out of the room, down the stairs, and out the back door. Now, to find Jack Ruby.
I'm Kurt Benrud, and I'm going to be reading Collector's Item by Daniel McPherson. I answer the door. The man who stands at the threshold opens his mouth to speak, then pauses, staring at me. The edges of his mouth curl into a grin, and he licks his lips. For reasons I do not understand, I am overcome by an urge to slam the door in his face. But my programming takes hold, and I ask, "Can I help you?" "Yes, pardon the interruption." He speaks politely now, his composure regained. "Is your owner at home?" "Who, may I ask, is calling?" "I am Zhenya Ostrovsky," he smiles. "I collect things." I hear Master Logan's voice behind me. "Mr. Ostrovsky, I'm sorry you troubled yourself coming over. As I explained on the phone, it's completely out of the question. I can't sell Adam." I turn to Master Logan, confused. "Sell me? May I at least step inside to discuss it?" "I suppose. Adam, would you see our guest in?" I lead the gaunt man to a chair, trying to hide the stiffness in my legs and the creak of my joints. Ostrovsky beams at me. "Fascinating. The Adam A1 was one of the first commercially available robotic servants. A poor seller, I'm afraid. Ahead of its time. Few are still in existence, and I've never seen one functioning so well." Logan smiles. "Adam has been in our family since before I was born. My father bought him the first week they were sold. He spent so much on him that my mother wouldn't speak to him for a month, but he was convinced robotics were the future. The market crash and depression dampened his enthusiasm, and when I was 6, he gave Adam to me. He's been my companion ever since. I couldn't imagine life without him." I only faintly remember belonging to Logan's father, but my recollections of Master Logan's childhood are vivid and rich. It would pain me to be parted from him. I'm pleased to hear that he feels the same. "Are you attached to him?" Logan shrugs. "I know it's difficult to understand. My friends think it's foolish." "Oh, not at all. I understand sentimentality. Why else would I collect these old units? There's something charming about them that goes beyond their usefulness as a mechanical servant. They're hybrid, cobbled-together technology. Spring-powered motors. Gear logic mingled with vacuum tubes. Where others see obsolescence, I see the brilliant optimism of an age gone by." "Then you understand why I can't sell him." He nods. "I appreciate your position, but consider. Collecting outdated technology is a game for the rich, which..." He gestures at our tiny apartment. "I am sad to say you are not. Your Adam is in remarkable condition for his age, but I see numerous dents and a fair amount of rust. He's had some sort of mishap in his left leg. You couldn't find the original knee plate or the correct screws. It's a patch job. Your repair isn't bad, but I noticed his limp as he let me in." Master Logan looks embarrassed. "He will have more problems. His vacuum tubes will fail, and you won't be able to replace them. One of his gears will crack. You won't find the correct part, and you won't be able to repair it. It takes considerable money to maintain these old models, and you do not have it." I want to object, but I know that everything he says is correct. I can restore him. Ostrovsky's eyes gleam as he looks at me.
through me. All original parts. Factory programming. He will be just as he was the day he was made. Logan shakes his head. I can't. I'm prepared, he continues, to offer you a trade. He steps to the door. If I may. A second man, younger and more plumply built, makes his way into our apartment, pushing something large under a beige sheet. My assistant, Rohit, the collector says. Rohit wheels his package to the center of the apartment and removes the cover. It is a household robot, the latest model from the same company that produced me over 50 years ago. Its ivory skin shines sleek and seamless. My own chassis seem clunky and quaint in comparison. I offer you this new Atom A52, Ostrovsky says, in addition to the payment offer I have already made. Master Logan is speechless. This unit is owned by the wealthiest celebrities and businessmen, the type of luxury Logan could not reasonably expect to see in his lifetime, much less own. Its processing power and physical capabilities exceed my own by an amazing margin. It's a generous offer, Logan says at last, but I still can't accept. As wonderful as I'm sure this robot is, it wouldn't be Adam. The collector laughs. Oh, but it will. We both look at him, confused. People don't understand how much of a unique identity robots can develop. Even now, their manufacturers assure us that their personalities are pre-programmed and interchangeable. And at first, perhaps, that is true. But you and I know that over time, these atoms develop their own attitudes and behaviors. After only a few months, they can already be easily distinguished from another supposedly identical unit. After so many years of continuous use, all with the same owners, I'm sure your Adam has his own personality as much as any human does. I would never propose to take your companion's personality away from you. Fortunately for us both, that is not necessary. Rohit has developed a method to transfer the programming from one of these old units into a new one. Logan looks doubtful. It's flawless, Ostrovsky continues. Challenging, of course. The gear logic must be converted to digital, and other adjustments must be made. But Rohit's method is foolproof. Your Adam can be moved into this new chassis. All of his memories, all of his thoughts and desires, all of him. The word no forms on Logan's lips, but he hesitates. He will be your old friend, in this new, vastly improved body, and you will sell his old, abandoned shell to me. Logan looks at me. I am already considering what our guest has said. He is correct about my system's aging and failing, and about Logan's inability to manage my decline. One of my vacuum tubes has already started to fail. I have avoided telling Master Logan. I think you should accept his offer, I say at last. Logan sighs and nods reluctantly. The collector claps his hands together. Rohit opens my chassis. I have to disconnect the speaker and motor control boards to access the system memory, he says, as he attaches probes to various points on my processing boards. He runs these to a small breakout box attached to a slim computer. From there, a single white cable leads to the new robot. As if by magic, the seamless shell of its chest opens to expose a small port into which Rohit plugs the cable. Under the robot's white skin, a faint blue light pulses slowly. Nothing happens for several minutes. All three men watch silently. At last, the new robot raises its head. It didn't work, I think. It worked, the robot says. Master Logan, it worked. No, I say, I'm still here. But my speaker board is still disconnected. Logan eyes the robot skeptically. That dent on your left shoulder, he points to me, my old chassis. I told my father you slipped on a spill in the kitchen and fell. What really happened? You had just discovered Tarzan, and we were wrestling. I was playing the role of an invading gorilla, and you pushed me from your bed into a quicksand pit, represented by your floor. How could he know that?
It is you, then. Logan's eyes glisten with joy. Adam, do you think you can live without that dent? He raises his arms, testing their strength. They're smooth, their rust-free movement. Yes, I believe I can get used to this. In horror, I realize what has happened. Rohit has copied all of my programming into this new chassis. Not transferred, but copied. All of what I know, what I am, who I am. Now this copy stands before Master Logan, fully convinced that he is me, possessing all of my memories and thoughts and identity, while I, the original, sit trapped in this disconnected shell. Reattach me, I plead. Reconnect me to my body so I can speak. The thin man counts a stack of bills and hands it to Master Logan. They shake hands. The technician disconnects his probes and cables, gathers his equipment. The robot gushes over his new body, thanking Master Logan. I recognize my own diction and speech patterns in his voice. No, I think, that's not me. But I realize that it is. A new copy of me, who believes himself to be the true original every bit as much as I do. A perfect copy. Master Logan will never know the difference. Logan embraces the new robot. As the collector carries me away, he doesn't give me another glance.
I'm Evelyn Evans, and I'm reading
Reversals by M. Bernardo. The birds are all screwed up this morning, and for a minute, I'm distracted by a swirling flock of swallows that climbs and dives around and around in a crazy loop outside the window. Then I shake my head and say to Njoki again, I don't want you leaving the house after school. She gives me her scornful look and folds her arms. I'm 16, Mama. I don't care how old you are, I say, and I mean it, even though I can see the stubbornness of a woman in her. The stubbornness, in fact, of a woman I know very well. Skeptical and willful and independent, not prone to quiet acquiescence to any authority as arbitrary as a mother. There's a high radiation warning today, and I want you to stay inside. Why can't I be inside Marion's house? I shake my head. How will you get there? Sometimes I don't think you think about things, Njoki. These days are not easy for her, I know. The high elevation and equatorial position of Nairobi already means we're susceptible to the punishing radiation of the sun, especially with the weakening magnetic field. But today, there is the added danger of solar flare activity. Dark skin and youthful obstinacy are not enough to protect anybody from the slow buildup of carcinogens, and the scientists say this could last 1,000 years or more until the magnetic poles finish their reversal. This won't get any better in Njoki's lifetime. You're going out, Njoki says. I have to work, I say, suddenly tired of the argument. Ordinarily, I would telecommute on a day with a high radiation warning, but I need to be on site to troubleshoot the servers. I don't have any choice. Early in the afternoon, when school is over, I find time to call home. I have to use a landline, of course. The radiation is frying all the cell towers today. When I was a girl, we thought landlines were quaint, an obsolete technology, and a relic of old-fashioned times. Now, many days, they are the only thing that works. That's how Njoki went to school today, through the cable modem. That's another difference from when I was a girl. Back then, they would have canceled classes. Today, they just tell the pupils to stay home and call in on video conferencing connections. I know it must be even duller than ordinary school without even the comfort of chatting with friends in the hall. For a moment, I feel kindly towards Njoki. It hasn't been easy for her. But then the phone on the other end of the line rings for the 8th time and goes to voicemail. Now I'm angry. But I try to keep it out of my voice. Perhaps Njoki is in the bathroom or listening to music. But I don't believe it. I leave a message telling her to call me right away. I have to work late and call again at 18:30, just before I leave. There is no return message on my voicemail. Njoki has not called me back. Again, the phone rings 8 times and goes to voicemail. This time, I hang up. In the bathroom, before I leave work, I catch sight of my face. My jaw is set like a sprung bear trap, my eyes glittering and hot. That is how I want to look, furious, outraged, insulted. I used to wear this face often with Njoki's father. He charmed me when I was young and stupid, but he proved insubstantial and unserious. This was a face that he feared, a face he saw when I came home to find he had lost another job. I wasn't sure where he was now, but at least he wasn't in my house making a fool out of me every day. I buy a potato and lamb curry on the way home and lay out 2 portions on the kitchen table for dinner. But the house is dark and quiet, and the message light flashes on the phone. Listening to the voicemail, I hear only my own voice, nothing from Njoki. When I finish my dinner, I throw Njoki's in the garbage. Stepping outside, I look up at the sky. It's dark now, the radiation warning long since passed with the setting of the sun. The aurora equatoris shimmer in the sky above Nairobi, green-blue curtains of wispy light high above the city, a testament to just how weak the magnetic field has grown. There are no true poles anymore at all now, no North Pole and no South Pole. Instead, they flip and change from day to day. Sometimes there are temporary shifting holes in the magnetic field, multiple poles sliding across the face of the globe, 6 or 8 or more at a time. Compass needles are no longer to be relied upon when the field is strong enough for them to work at all. We'll live through it, certainly, but for now, it's chaos. I go back inside the house and consider calling Marion's parents or the parents of Njoki's other friends, but I cannot imagine asking any of them if they have seen my daughter, what they would think of me, how foolish I would look then, and if Njoki were with any of them, she would call. No, this is more than the usual teenage thoughtlessness. Whether Njoki knows it or not, this is an act of secession. Then suddenly I am in her bedroom. I don't recall making a decision or having any clear thought, but I am pulling clothes out of her closet and hurling them down the stairs to the hall below. I look around her room to see what she owns, but that is all there is. Clothes, 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 and piles of shoes. I shovel the shoes into plastic garbage bags and haul them downstairs as well. I sit down angrily in the living room among Njoki's possessions and stare at the creeping hands of the grandfather clock. After an hour, I feel almost foolish. Njoki thinks she is a woman, I know that, but equally, I know she is not one, not yet. Do I need to prove it to her like this? She's proud, like me. Do I need to break her pride in order to win her obedience? Sheepishly, I carry her clothes and shoes back up to her room again. I put the hangers back in the closet and pile the shoes underneath. But in the living room once more, there is still nothing to do but watch the hands of the clock. Then the door clicks open, and Njoki creeps into the darkened hallway. I stand and look at her, and a ray of pale moonlight falls across her face. I'm shocked by the change from this morning. Not just the dried tears and smudged makeup, but utter youngness of her face. Somehow she has been transformed into almost a child before me. Seeing me, she drops her handbag with a low cry and then comes forward and clutches me in a tight hug. I'm bewildered and staggered, and all I can do is press her back. Where is the willful, scornful woman of this morning? Where did this clinging, sighing child come from? Another time, I might be ashamed of such total regression. But now I can only feel the painful beating of my own heart in my tightening chest. I know, of course, the answer to the riddle. Njoki said it herself that morning. She is 16. As I hold her, I only hope for both our sakes that these changes and these reversals will take something less than 1,000 years to complete.
Hello, everyone. My name is Seema Kukreja, and I'll be reading My Daughter's Smile by J. Lee Curl. I carefully prepare her plate. She can be finicky sometimes. The peas are the tricky part. They cannot touch anything. None of her food can touch. Thanks, Dad, she says, as I set her dinner in front of her. Hey, I thought we had talked about this. I point to the fork beside her plate, bent at a 90-degree angle. She looks at me with a devilish smile. That was your grandmother's silverware. You know I don't like it when you bend it. Now straighten it back out. Still smiling, her eyes roll gently back. They remain partially open, exposing only the whites of her eyes. The fork, still lying on the table next to her plate, begins to slowly straighten. It's tough being a single parent sometimes, especially when your 8-year-old child has, shall I say, a special gift. I fix my plate and sit down at the table beside her. So, how was your school today, I ask. Okay, but I can tell by the way she looks down, rolling a single pea around on her plate with her fork, that something is up. Did something happen, I ask. It's Billy Martin, Dad. He's always picking on me. Today on the playground, he snuck up behind me and pulled my ponytail. Well, I smile. That's the way little boys show they like you. He wouldn't pick on you if he didn't like you. Yeah, well, I turned around and I put my hand up to his chest. You didn't knock him back, did you? I interrupt. You know, the way you did me that time? I started to, she says. But I remembered what you said. I cannot do that anymore, especially not at school. I'll get in trouble. Yes, you will. And again, when you get home. I know, she says, rolling her eyes. So, what did you do? I ask. I just looked at him mean and turned around and walked away. But then, I saw him, you know, in my head. He was coming up behind me. He was gonna do it again. But somebody... She looks up at the ceiling with that same devilish smile, her index finger lightly tapping her cheek. Somebody ties his shoelaces together, and he fell on his face. I almost blow peas out of my nose. Yeah, it's tough being a single parent sometimes. Maybe after her bedtime. Maybe I can sneak a bear. Maybe, she says with a smile. Thank you.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.